Hey, I'm Carlos Frias, the host of Sundial. Want to know where your dollars to public radio go? Listen to the two great conversations we have coming up for you during our spring pledge drive. First, we'll talk to Joanne Hippolyte. She spent 8 years as History Miami's chief curator before taking her talents to D.C. Now she's a curator at the National Museum of African American History. She talks about growing up hearing too little about Black history, and now she makes a career at the Smithsonian of showing us how Black people shaped American culture. Then we shift gears and talk with longtime movie critic Rene Rodriguez. He went from driving a delivery truck at a high school to getting angry phone calls at home from Sylvester Stallone. He tells stories from more than 25 years as a movie reviewer and how he helps others fall in love with movies now, hosting films at the University of Miami. That's on Sundial in 5 minutes after the news. I'm Carlos Frias. Welcome to Sundial during our spring pledge drive. Joanne Hippolyte grew up hearing very little about Black history. She was born in Haiti but raised in Boston, and she went to an Irish Catholic school where they spent a lot of time talking about American history, but not much about Black people's role in it. Joanne wanted to tell the stories she rarely heard. She made a career out of helping tell the important ways in which Black people influenced all aspects of American culture. Now she helps others learn that history. She's a curator at the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. She focuses on the achievements of the African diaspora and how it shaped America. South Florida played an important role for her. She got her Ph.D. at the University of Miami, then spent 8 years as History Miami's chief curator before taking her talents to D.C. She joined us to talk about her national role with the Smithsonian and why she still calls Miami home. But first, she took us to her Haitian home in Boston, where she grew up.
I always think of my house as an island. You know, you think about going back to your homeland, the island itself, but I thought of my house as an island. We in that house, we spoke Creole and some English, and we ate predominantly Haitian food. There were these boxes that would come to us from Haiti and the Caribbean that had all of the like wonderful treats and goods, you know, the candies and the deuce, the sweets, the mangoes that we couldn't get in Boston that were, you know, so we would open those up, and it was like having the island with us there and the culture there with us. And outside of my house, I was in an African American neighborhood, predominantly Black, in Dorchester. And I loved that as well, because I got to understand the flavors of African-American food, the culture. I had a lot of friends in that neighborhood, the dancing, the history of dancing. I would go to their churches. So early on, I had a very strong a sense of African-American culture and a real appreciation for it as well. And then on top of that, my parents were, you know, self-segregating us, like busing us out of our neighborhoods, which is great because the busing crisis was happening in Boston at the time. There was a lot of racial strife, and they were sending us to an all-white, predominantly Irish Catholic school in Brookline, Massachusetts, because they just wanted us to have a strong Catholic education. That's very important for certain segments of the Haitian population, and also just a strong, a quality education, which they didn't think the local public schools would be able to offer. So talk about all those worlds, right? My Haitian island home, and then the African-American community. And I always make this funny little joke that all of my friends on my neighborhood used to go down south in the summertime, and because that's where they would go visit their relatives. And I thought down south was like a place, like I didn't like a state. I was right. Like, where's down south?
The state of down south?
Yeah, the state of down south, exactly. And then the white Irish Catholic school. So I think that's why I ended up being so attracted to studying culture when I got to college.
I've heard folks here, especially in the Caribbean here in Miami, talk about finding your place when you're Caribbean Black, you know, you're Afro-Caribbean among American Black, and then kind of like trying to see how you fit in there, because those communities are disparate here. And I was wondering, how did that affect you growing up in a place in Boston where, you know, from the outside world, white people might have just said, you know, they looked at your skin and you said, you're just Black. So how did you find your identity within that?
So within the Black community, I think there was a respect and an understanding of different types of cultures. So in my neighborhood, there were also a couple of Trinidadian families, and they didn't know much about Haiti. They would ask me where Haiti was and what it was about, and they knew my grandmother didn't speak any English when she was sitting out there in the stoop. And to them, I was just a part of the neighborhood. I would say that once I left the neighborhood, I was very much, profiled in the same way that all Black people are often profiled in the United States. And so my neighborhood was considered a bad neighborhood because it was predominantly Black. It was considered, to be criminalized in a lot of ways. And I was recognized as being Black, not Haitian. In fact, when people met or talked to me or learned I was Haitian, they would think that that was strange. So they had this idea outside of my neighborhood. They had this idea of what they thought Haiti was, which I didn't know where they were getting those perceptions from, but it was largely from the negative media that was emerging during that period of time because of the Haitian migration crisis.
Sure. How did having that kind of upbringing and then seeing it, how it compared to the areas around you, especially when you got out of your community, how did that influence you in wanting to study more about, Black people's influence and Haitian influence and the African diaspora?
Yeah, I think that it was definitely being able early on, being able to see that there were differences between cultures, between what I was seeing with the Irish step dancing versus African American,
Yeah,
moves,
that's a clash, right?
versus Haitian compas dancing, and all of it was vibrant and interesting and colorful, right? And so tied to your ethnicity. I think that I understood that there are lots of differences between people, just in Boston where I was growing up, and that it was important because we were keeping it. We were somehow maintaining it and using it, doing the cultural shows at school. And like I said, still having the balls, the parties that you would go to, the Haitian parties. So they were an important part of life. And I think where it clicked for me was really when I got to college, because I knew these things. So the anthropologist and great writer, Zora Neale Hurston, has this great quote where she says, she uses anthropology as a lens. She says, I had to see myself like someone else, in order to understand how important it was. So what college let me do was step out of like the intrinsic part of who I was and everything I was experiencing and see the historical dynamics and conditions that were creating that, all of the traditions, where they were rooted in, the connection to Africa, it helped ground me in my African American studies classes, the migration patterns, the whole way that this country has sort of become the wonderful, place that it is with so many different cultures and identities coming together to make up what we call America, right? The United States. Miami is one of those places you walk around, everyone thinks I speak Spanish. They just assume that you speak Spanish. You don't do that. You don't get that in other cultures. You get your cafecito. There's lots of, food goods offered. In Boston, there were two Haitian bakeries that we patronized. In Miami, there are, 20, 25, if not more,
Right, and new ones
that you
every
can
day.
go. Exactly. And it influences the landscape, Little Haiti, the way that space looks with its murals, and the Iron Market art inspired architecture of the marketplace there. It was like finding home in a very different way because it was public rather than inside my home, inside the island home that I had in Boston. It was like they brought the island to the rest of outside the home as well. And I was,
There is something about you're driving by like the Little Haiti Cultural Center and just like that stretch, and you just feel like this community really has built something significant here, like a cultural center, you know?
Yeah, and it's unlike anything that you see in other places in this country as well. It's unique, and it's beautifully self-created. Yeah, it wasn't they weren't given money by the city of Miami to create this space, right? Or by developers. No,
They
it
built
comes out.
themselves.
Yeah, it's completely vernacular. It comes from the people.
And how did that affect your work as you were, as your chief curator of History of Miami, and you're deciding, what you want to put forward to the public? It's part of that history that maybe you hadn't grown up with.
It definitely affected the type of work that we take on. The History of Miami has always had a strong folk life division, and I was the curator. I was initially the folklife curator there, and so my work was to be in the community doing community research, collecting objects that reflected that community for posterity, so we could tell stories about them, that they were here and that they had an impact on Miami, and also to put on exhibitions about them. So not only do I my loving all this culture, learning about it in school, right down the road at the University of Miami, and then studying it and doing research on the ground, I then get to do something with it, create a product, an important product that educates other people about it, the public, which is what I love about museums. You don't have to take an African-American history class or Caribbean literature class. Only 40% of Americans even go to college, and do they even take those classes, right? Mm. So where else can you learn, right, about Cuban history or Santeria culture or African-American foodways? Museums provide that important vehicle.
You mentioned history, which Florida has been involved in this conversation about teaching African-American history and teaching Black history. And the AP course that was recently amended to have fewer sections of it because the Florida governor and the administration had an opposition to it. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
I think that I'll just say that I think that we're in interesting times, right? And thank God for museums.
Still to come, we'll continue our conversation with Joanne Hippolyte. She's the Supervisory Museum Curator of the African Diaspora at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Before that, she was the Chief Curator at History Miami Museum. If you like interviews like this, remember, your contributions to public radio help us make your favorite shows, like Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial during our Spring Pledge Drive. I'm Carlos Frias. We return to our conversation with Joanne Hippolyte. She's a curator at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. She's from Haiti and grew up in Boston, but to her, Miami is home. She got her PhD at the University of Miami and left her mark on the community working with History Miami for 8 years. Her work in Washington, D.C. focuses on the African diaspora, which she nurtured during her time in South Florida. I spoke with her about the exhibits she curated at our nation's capital and how her Miami roots influenced that work.
I'll talk to you about one of my favorite things, which is my gallery on the fourth floor of the museum. It's called Cultural Expressions. And the fourth floor is the culture floor. So, and I'm on a team of curators that are called culture curators, all the curators divided by art, history, and culture. So how great it is that I got to fall into culture when I love culture so much.
Wow, absolutely.
It's been such a part of my life. Cultural Expressions, look, it's a permanent exhibition, which means it's on display for, 15 to 20 years. And it looks at five ways in which Black people express culture, and I got to think about it diasporically. So it looks at foodways, culture, and cuisine, right? We were just talking about that. Language, the power of the word. Mm-hmm. Style, image, and identity, which is about how Black people style themselves, clothing, fashion, as well as, beauty and hair.
What an exciting way to try to really put your arms around and really capture a flavor of all these kind of major ways that Black people have influenced American culture. Kind of going inside each one of those five things, language is a great one. So give me an example there of how you guys try to show that range.
One of my favorite aspects of the language section is the piece on Wiley College and Texas Southern University, who had really great debate teams during the early 1900s. And they would go into the South and they would debate predominantly white teams, and they would win. They had a really great great track record of winning. And what they talked in their memoirs about, they would go into these spaces in the South where people thought they were completely ignorant and inferior. And then they would hear these students, right, debating topics in mainstream American English in very sophisticated ways and winning debates. And they would change minds just from that, just from being able to speak regular old, mainstream American English.
Right. And mm-hmm. and how important to be able to capture some of these things on a national scale, where you can tell some of those stories that might have been lost if not for being captured in a place like a museum. You mentioned also one of these other pillars that you studied was style, and I know that you've been really looking into the artist Art Smith and how he expressed culture in jewelry. Will you talk about that a little bit?
You've really done your homework on me. Art Smith is my
man. I have great producers.
Yeah, Smith is a mid-century modernist jeweler who also is an immigrant American. He was born in Cuba because his family had moved from Jamaica to work in the Cuban sh in the figure sugar factory in
Which
Cuba, which,
in
by
and
the
of
way,
itself is
yeah,
very interesting. A Jamaican
fascinating.
immigrants growing up in Cuba.
Exactly. And tons of Haitians were there as well. So there was a lot of inter-Caribbean migration into Cuba to work in the sugar fields. He ends up moving with his family to Harlem, and his family had gotten involved, believe it or not, with the UNIA, the United Negro Improvement Association, which is Marcus Garvey's organization
Oh,
in
wow.
Cuba. So people don't often realize there was a strong UNIA in that part of the world as well. And then he moved, they move over to the United States, and they become a part of the UNIA in New York. And he goes to art school here, and he has learned sculpture and design, and becomes one of the only Black people, who participated in what we call the mid-century modernist jewelry movement. And what that really means is that these were handmade works, craftsmen, beautiful sculptural objects that he created, and they were sold at Bergdorf's and Macy's and boutiques all over the country. He had a shop in Greenwich Village from the mid-1940s until the late 1970s. And even just within that shop, it's a microcosm of the United States, because he was harassed because he was Black and gay, and he was in a predominantly Italian neighborhood in New York. And he had to get protection from the police at some point. But it's also this wonderful bohemian space where he can explore our creativity and artistry, and he builds a strong clientele. And he's one of the few people who gets these wonderful museum exhibitions about them during his lifetime, about his work as a craftsman. So I'm working very closely. I've been working to build a strong collection of his work and archival material related to him at the museum, because I think we should be able to represent him and his significance.
And you bring up an interesting point too, which is breaking down that monolith further and further of Black culture. And you talk about someone who's a history of Black and gay, and those voices that have not been traditionally heard from as much either.
Yeah, exactly. Very important to be able to speak to the discrimination that they've experienced over time. It's not like it is today, and even today it isn't even great. But again, inclusion is really important, and reflecting the fact that these are communities that have always been with us and have made major contributions to their cultures and to the United States is vital.
And tell me about some of those jewelry pieces. Like, what is it that makes them special?
How do you explain an Art Smith piece?
Right.
I think it has a lot of jazz, because he used to listen to jazz music the whole time, and he was so all of his work, especially his earrings, have a lot of mobility and swing to them. He believed the body was a component in design. That's actually really important when you think about how Black bodies are so dismissed in this country, right? Our Black bodies are torn apart or violated or destroyed in so many different ways. But he really believed in the body as an important aspect of design. There is no ring, there is no earring, right, without the body itself, right, as a basic component, and valued the body.
And he celebrated motion, kind of, is what you're saying, like those move earrings that moved and what have you.
Correct. Yeah, mobility, like you would see with mobiles, and just the waves and the movement, like you can almost see the rhythm in it.
You can feel the whole movement in them, and even as they're moving about. I'm curious about, because you obviously this is another kind of Caribbean representation in the museum. Can you talk about ways that Black South Florida shows up in the museum? Things that folks might recognize it, or maybe a piece that's been brought from South Florida that is expressed there for a national audience.
Yeah, I'm very thrilled to have brought in a costume from Bahamas Junkanoo Revue, which is a Junkanoo band in South Florida that I've known for a long time from my time in History Miami there. And Junkanoo has been practiced in South Florida. I mean, it was there long before the Goombay Festival, and that went away after a while, since I was visiting Miami in the 1980s. And it's a beautiful costume. It's a strong representation of carnival traditions, and that people have brought with them from the Caribbean to the United States and are still practicing. And it's on you can actually see it on our catalog, our online catalog. It's beautifully photographed, and it's used in a book that just came out called Musical Crossroads, which is about all of the different genres of music Black people have brought to this country, but also also helped create and influence. And so we paid attention to Caribbean influences as well. There's a photograph of Virginia Key Beach, and
Oh, wow.
It's not, yeah, there's not, you wouldn't think it was not the beach itself. It's the food. It's the stand, the actual concession stand, and all the kids are, it's a famous photograph. All the kids are sitting there and they're ordering their food. And we just talk about food, right, as a space, as a contested space. In cultural expressions, it's not just the celebration of all the wonderful types of cuisines Black people have helped develop and create here in the country, but also the ways in which food and sitting at the table is politicized. You had to sit, you know, not couldn't sit down at lunch counters, or why we had to desegregate lunch counters, but also the enjoyment and the joy surrounding food. So all these kids at the concession stand and enjoying what is a segregated beach, right, at the time, and making what they can of that.
That was Joanne Hippolyte. She's a supervisory curator at the Museum of African American History in Washington, D.C. Before that, she was the chief curator at History Miami Museum. You can listen to our full conversation on our website at wlrn.org or in your podcast app. Just search WLRN Sundial. Still to come, we hear from movie critic Rene Rodriguez how he went from being a truck driver to getting angry phone calls at home from Sylvester Stallone. He was the film critic for the Miami Herald for more than 25 years. Now he's the manager of the Cosford Cinema at the University of Miami. But first, we need your support to bring you more conversations like this one. Welcome back to Sundial during our spring pledge drive. I'm Carlos Frias. Long before he was a movie critic, Rene Rodriguez sat at the back of a movie theater watching E.T. and cried. Then, he saw the movie 16 more times in that same theater. For more than 25 years, he was one of America's best-known movie reviewers. Now he screens movies at the Cosford Cinema at the University of Miami, which is named after his mentor at the Miami Herald, the late Bill Cosford. He uses his Hollywood connections to bring stars to the Cosford to talk film. Oscar winner Rami Malek came to watch the film Bohemian Rhapsody with the crowd. And he invites prominent South Florida residents to pick a movie and watch it with the audience. He calls the series Watching Movies With. It all started with going to the movies with his dad as a kid. They would slip into the theater midway through the picture and stay to watch the beginning, like his dad did back in Cuba. Okay, here's Rene.
So, Sylvester Stallone moved to Miami, very famously. I forget what year it was.
He had a house near Alice Wainwright Park, near the bay there.
Correct.
Yeah.
And it was the year that he made Judge Dredd and he made Daylight. Now, we had given him a King's welcome in the Miami Herald. Lydia Martin wrote this fantastic front page profile. It was called Citizen Sly. Like, I remember the headline. It was a beautiful portrait of him. And, you know, it was a big deal that Sylvester Stallone was moving to Miami full time. But then these two movies come out and...
And they're bombs.
Well, it's not that they're bombs. It's that they were terrible. They were just terrible movie. And I remember there was a line in my Judge Dredd review where I said something along the lines of, Stallone's pal Bob Dole probably would not appreciate the violence in this movie because Bob Dole was on a campaign to, you know, tone down violence in movies. And then in Daylight, I really went to town on it because that movie's just terrible. And so I get a call from his assistant and he's like, hey, Sly is really mad at you. And I'm like, why? And he's like, because like you're treating all his movies like they were garbage and he wants to meet with you.
That is so, he wants to intimidate you, but that's so random.
Well, I was just like, sure, you know, like, let's go, you know. So I went to his house. There was an appointment set, and I go into his house.
Wait, his house is not my house in Flagami. What is it like when you get there?
Well, I had been there before.
Gates?
I snuck into, when they opened up the Planet Hollywood in Coconut Grove, he had a party at his house because he was one of the investing partners of Planet Hollywood.
Yeah, and I believe that there was a statue of him frozen in ice from one of his movies, Demolition Man, which is one of my favorite action movies.
That one's pretty good.
That one's pretty good. Okay, so you get to his house.
But I snuck in at the party just really
house.
Quickly. Yeah, I had to snuck in, and the thing is, I was supposed to have a publicist at my side at all times. And the first thing I did was I ditched the publicist. And so you have to realize this is a house party where everyone is famous. So, for example, I bummed a cigarette off the Bee Gees. And so I smoked a cigarette with the Bee Gees. Jean-Claude Van Damme cut in front of me at the bar because he looked at me he's like, I was a nobody, so he just
like, this guy's not famous enough.
Yeah, because everybody there is famous. Cindy Crawford, Bruce Willis, and Demi Moore showed up with their new baby in a carriage, and they're just normal people. Everybody was just oohing and aahing over their baby, and they're like, oh, aren't they cute? And it was just a very out-of-body experience. But there are celebrities, and then there are celebrities. And at the end of the night, Madonna, who lived next door, came over. She just crossed the backyard. And everybody at that party all of a sudden became starstruck.
Wow, how interesting.
Yes. And so Sly, Madonna, and the Estefans posed for a group picture. And I just got into the corner of it, of the photo next to Emilio Estefan. And, you know, they took the photo. And I asked the photographer, where is this going to appear? They said People Magazine. I was like, awesome. And the photo did appear in People Magazine, but they crossed me out.
So they cut you out of the photo?
All you see is my elbow, because I remember the shirt that I was wearing, but they cropped me out because they were probably like, who's this guy? Who's this bum?
I know that's Madonna. I know that's Sylvester Stallone. That's Demi Moore. And
right. But man, like, I wish I had a copy of that photo.
You have the most famous elbow in that photo.
But anyways, so I go to Stallone's house. Again, this is for our formal off the record sit down.
Yep.
And we talked for an hour. He was an enchanting, charming guy. He was so funny. He's so intelligent. He's not at all what, you know, and it wasn't a confrontational
thing. Right. He's not Rocky.
Right. No.
He's the guy
that wrote Rocky. Right. Exactly. But then at one point, you know, it was a very friendly, cordial conversation. I remember I was looking around and every single inch of his house was decorated like with Gianni Versace and stuff like that. He asked me, can I get you anything to drink? I'm like, water's fine. And his maid comes with this goblet that had like jewels encrusted on it. And I was so afraid of dropping it that I just set it on the table and I didn't drink water because that glass looked really expensive, you know? And so we're having a nice conversation. And then he goes, you know, when I'm in a movie, everyone assumes that I wrote it and directed it. I'm just an actor. Like, I didn't write and direct these movies. I'm just an actor. I show up to act. And I told him, well, but Sly, but these movies get made because of you. Judge Dredd got made because of you. Daylight got made because you were in it. He's like, yeah, but, you know, when critics review these movies, they always come after me. Like, it's not my fault. You know, like, I'm only an actor. You know, that was his argument. But it was a very cordial conversation.
But then there was the time where it kept sliding, right? And then at one point he decided to leave Miami.
Yes. So he made this movie called Copland, which he made for very low money. It was a way for him to show his acting chops.
And it was actually very good.
And it was a fantastic movie. And so I interviewed him for that. And he sent me a letter, which I have hanging on my refrigerator. It was on his letterhead. And it said, Rene.
Do the voice.
I'll do my best, but you do that better. Your words touched my heart. Love, Sly.
And you can't help but read that without hearing his voice, right?
Of course.
Your words touched my heart.
Right, right.
But he also called you, there was some guy in traffic, and he's
right.
Like...
Right, so then later, I can't remember the circumstance of the phone call, but he was leaving Miami. He had put his house on the market for Miami. And I was asking him, like, why he was leaving. He's like, well, Rene, you know, like, people take advantage of me there.
Do
like,
the voice.
The air conditioning guy comes over because my air conditioning is broken, and he says, it's going to cost you $25,000 to fix it. How does an air conditioner cost $25,000 to fix? You know, people are just taking advantage of me, and plus, I don't feel welcome there anymore. And I said, what do you mean? He's like, well, the other day, like, I was in my limo driving around Coconut Grove, and I had lowered the window to do something, and some kids recognized me. And like, we were walking by, and they're like, hey, Sly. And I leaned out the window to wave hi to them. And they responded by saying, F you, and, and flashing me their middle fingers. And he was like, what did I ever do to deserve this? I haven't done anything. So yeah, I'm leaving Miami.
He said, that hurt my feelings.
It hurt my feelings. Like, that hurt my feelings. Like, what did I ever do to those kids?
It's funny. But I also get it. I have to laugh at it, but I feel for him. Like
I
celebrities,
do too.
They're just like us.
Exactly. Yeah. Like they're just like us. And yeah, like he moved away. But yeah, that's my Stallone.
That was Rene Rodriguez. He's the manager of the Cosford Cinema at the University of Miami and a lifelong movie critic. You can listen to our full conversation on our website at wlrn.org or in your podcast app. Just search WLRN Sundial. And that's Sundial for Thursday, March 16th. Leslie Ovalle-Atkinson is our lead producer. Elisa Baena is our producer and social media editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's VP of News. Katie Munoz is our director of live programming. Peter J. Mertz is WLRN's vice president of radio and Sundial's engineer. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. You can download a podcast of this program. Just search WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. Coming up next week on the program, we're back with new live Sundial episodes. Joining us is Puerto Rican singer-songwriter Ile. She toured around the world with her brothers in the hip-hop group Calle 13 before going solo in 2016. Her next stop is Fort Lauderdale at the end of the month. She tells us how her boleros and folk songs are personal and political. I'm Carlos Frias. Thanks for listening.